I'd like to take these couple of moments that we usually have for our introduction to really say thank you to our speaker today, Ellen Elberding. Well, we know this will be far from her last time here at City Club. It is her 15th time. There's got to be some kind of record. And it will likely be her last as the president of the Joyce Foundation as she plans to retire after 22 years at the helm of this great institution. For some 20-plus years that I've known Ellen, she's been just a centrifugal force in Chicago's civic community, spearheading so many different initiatives to improve Chicago and the region. And I knew from my time in the mayor's office that if Ellen and Mayor Daley, if they agreed that something was worth tackling, look out, it was going to happen. She's always been a force and continues to be. That collaboration has continued with mayors and governors since, as Joyce Foundation has always been positively influencing policies on a number of fronts in Chicago and Illinois and in the Great Lakes region. From the Great Lakes Cities Initiative to education reforms, gun control to poverty alleviation, and democracy. Now, just fresh water, guns, and democracy. I would call that saving and changing the world. I'd love to know, Ellen, how many lives have actually been impacted positively by all that you've done and saved lives, really, as a result of these initiatives and investments under your leadership. What's even better is that she's led this dynamic team and identified next-generation leaders all along the way to ensure that this momentum continues. Of course, her husband, Kelly Welsh, has been right alongside her, as he is today, making his mark on Chicago in so many different capacities. Corporation Counsel for the City at Northern Trust, U.S. Commerce Department, and of course, the Civic Committee, just to name a few. Thank you, Kelly, and thank you for sharing Ellen with Chicago. We are a far better city and region because of the two of you. Thank you. So we are also very fortunate to have one of our favorite moderators here, Laura Washington. Award-winning journalist, columnist, and political analyst. She's going to lead this conversation with Ellen. Thank you, Laura, for that. So while I know this won't be the last time, it certainly is a significant milestone to celebrate today. So please join me in welcoming back to the City Club the president of the Joyce Foundation, Ellen Elberding. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you.
I always have too much stuff.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for that introduction. And I just have to add my little two cents to the plaudits. 34 years at the foundation, total, right? 22 years is in the leadership position. 15 appearances at the City Club. I understand that's a record. No one has ever done that. No one will ever top that one. But that says everything about your role as a civic leader in this city. And I just want to say thank you on behalf of myself in terms of some of the causes that I've been associated with that I've worked with you on over the years. And on behalf of, I know, so many of you in the room who I'm sure share that thank you and gratitude. And the city would not be where it is today, I would say, without you.
Thank you, Laura.
And so speaking of that, this is Chicago 2024, and you came on board as CEO in what year was that?
2001.
Okay. So how would you say, what would you say the city looked like in 2001, really important time in our history?
Yeah.
And not only did this, what the city looked like, but the challenges and issues that faced your foundation and in philanthropy.
Well, first of all, thank you, Laura. I couldn't have imagined a better companion to be up here. You just warned me, though, if I get too comfortable, it could get dangerous in this conversation. And I did preemptively turn my mic off while I was sitting at the table, just in case. And I really appreciate everyone who's here and is taking time out of their busy, hot days to be here. It really means a lot to just see your faces in the room and to know how many people I've worked with that I have so much respect for. And we're going to talk about a bunch of things, but before I start, I want to say there is nothing that we have gotten done as an organization without our unbelievable staff. And if you would all just, like, raise your hands and just say, I mean... We are really blessed by an incredibly smart, focused, mission-driven, and talented group of people. So, you know, whatever I say here, if it sounds like I'm taking any credit at all, let me say right now, I'm not. So when I started, I was thinking back on this, and when I started this job, there were like these bookends over a period of 7 or 8 years. The first one was... 9/11 happened, and 9/11 was, you know, just this massive thing for our entire country and for our city. And in addition to disrupting what we all sort of thought about the world, I think it really set the seeds for the xenophobia that we're all really struggling with now. So that was one thing that happened. And then very shortly after that, we had the financial crisis. And the Joyce Foundation has many assets, including brains, but a lot of it is money. We lost 40% of our assets in just a couple of weeks. And so from the idea of managing an organization that had made all sorts of assumptions about what the world is like, you know, we have 9/11, and then we have this tremendous loss of, you know, our basic resources. And how do you manage through that? How do you maintain the relationships and the support that you have for our grantees and your staff? And what's a responsible way of handling that?
And how did you manage through that?
Well. On the financial, I would say during the financial crisis, the board really had to make a decision about whether we were going to eat into what remained of our assets in order to keep our staff in place and keep our support for our grantees even. And when you do that, if you can do the math, you know, like it has a very negative impact on your ability to do grant making going forward. But the decision we made was to keep things even, and so we paid out a lot more money than we normally, as a percent, than we normally would. I would say, Rahm Emanuel is famous for saying, "Never waste a crisis." There were also things that we were doing that I thought, you know, it's a good time to maybe make some changes here. So there was some of that going on as well. But bookending those two sort of crisis situations, and there were lots of other things in between, we had in 2008 the election of Barack Obama. And he obviously, I think people know he was on our board, as was Valerie Jarrett. And the election of someone whom we knew well and with whom we were so well aligned on policy opened up a tremendous amount of opportunity for us. So on the one hand, you know, early in my tenure, we had these crises. On the other hand, we had an incredible opportunity at the federal level, working with people like Arne Duncan and lots of folks that we knew at the federal level to really move policy issues that we had done a lot of work on in the past. But here the doors were opening for us in a way that hadn't previously. We were pounding on the doors, and sometimes they inched open. Mm-hmm. But in this case, we'd walk up, and they would be open already. And that that was a very satisfying experience for us. You know, some of the folks in the room, like Nina Vinnick, was part of that set of opportunities when we were working on gun issues and law enforcement issues at the federal level.
Before you move, I think you're going to move to the next historic moment, but the Barack Obama era, as you said, he was on your board, and that created another huge challenge for you, and you were sort of thrown into the middle of a of a maelstrom.
Yeah.
Because of the politics behind it, and because the right wanted to discredit him and therefore discredit you in that relationship. What was that like, and how did you handle that?
There were two things that were really tremendous learning experiences for me in that first chunk of time. For one thing, we worked on gun issues, and in a period where there was no other, we didn't have partners there. You know, there wasn't Bloomberg at the time. There weren't March for Our Lives. Those organizations that are, you know, out there now and doing great work weren't there. And so we were the, you know, so to speak, the target of the National Rifle Association during a period where they were ascendant. They were incredibly powerful. And they made threats against us. We were on the front page of their magazine saying, follow the money, you know, and it went right to us and therefore to me. And so there was a sense of, I guess, danger. I mean, these guys, they hated us and they had guns and they made threats. So there was like this sense of like, how much of this can we absorb? Mm. Can I personally absorb? And how much are we willing to absorb on the part of the foundation? So there was that whole thing that was happening. And what I learned from that was that I had a capacity to absorb a lot of it and keep. I was just, you know what? Damn the torpedoes! We are going to keep doing this, but it really helped that the board at the time. I got regular phone calls saying, if this doesn't work for you, or you and your team are feeling threatened, we'll back away. Like, don't feel pressured by us to keep going on something.
Back away from the commitment to gun control.
You don't need to be so public. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be doing this. There's lots of other things we could be doing. They didn't want to.
Wow.
But
yeah.
they were giving me the option, which was very, very helpful. Sure. Anyway, nothing changed. We kept going. And we had our moments. Then the other thing was, when Obama was running for president, there were, you know, it was crazy time. I mean, you know, they were finding every relationship he had that they could attack him with. We were part of that, so they were attacking us all the time. One of the things I learned from my husband was how to talk to reporters and say words and not give them a single thing they could quote. words came out. Mm-hmm. I saw this happen in the previous decade when Kelly was corporation counsel for the city, and words would come out of my mouth, and I'm sure they sat, and then the reporter would be like, what the heck did she just say? I don't know. That was a talent that I learned at the time. Yeah. My reporter team members are laughing over here.
Yeah, well, you don't want to be on the other end of that, unfortunately. That doesn't do a reporter any good.
Sorry.
But that's not your problem, right?
Sorry. So there were a lot of struggles. But at the same time, and I don't want to keep praising my husband excessively, but another thing that I learned from Kelly is how important it is to hire fabulous people. I mean, I saw him do that in job after job. The most important thing, first thing he did, was hire really good people at City Hall and in other places. And I really focused on that for the foundation. And you know, I just wanted an A-plus team around us. And I really, you know, hey, guys, I think we succeeded. We have, you know, we've always had an A-plus team. And some, you know, folks move on and go and do other great things. But I feel great about that.
You have some very talented alumni out there, too, who have done a lot of great things.
Yeah, so I feel good about that. So we had two young daughters. I had a daughter. We had a daughter in fourth grade and a daughter in sixth grade when I started this job, and that's a tender age. You know, those next 10 years of their lives, you want to be there for them. So, I also thought it was really important for our staff to model the fact that you know it's important to be there for your kids or for your family, and I modeled that. I showed up for, you know, softball games and all that stuff. So anyway, that was the first era.
Mm-hmm. So how has the world of philanthropy changed over these 30-some years that you've been in this role? And how has Chicago changed?
Well, first of all, I think Chicago I mean, one thing to realize is that we're a regional foundation. We do work all over the region, and we spend a lot of time in New York and D.C. and other cities as a result of the type of work that we do. I've never been in a city where there was a higher level of collaboration and low ego in terms of partnering. I mean, you know, I've got, you know, two or three great partners, four great partners I can see right here, and our willingness to work together, both among the private philanthropies but also in the business community, is really unique. Most other cities that I'm very familiar with, it's a lot of, you know, elbowing for position and so on, and I just don't. There's always some of that, but I just don't see it that much here. In fact, I see the opposite. You know, partnering with MacArthur, partnering with the Trust, partnering with Gillian at, you know, at Gillian Darlow, partnering with McCormick. You know, we've had lots and lots of advantages because we work together on issues. And we don't always agree on what the strategies are, what the outcomes should be, but I think we've found ways to, like, what's the overlap and, you know, what's the Venn diagram of the thing that we can all lean in on, and that's a huge plus.
And what? But
you asked me what's changed.
Yeah.
And one thing that's changed, first of all, there's a lot more pressure on us on, let's say, ESG, or let's say payout, which is an obscure term if you don't know it, but it's, you know, hey, you've got all that money, why don't you spend it now? Why are you hanging on to it for the future? There's, you know, there's a lot of dialogue around.
There's a debate about that, yes.
Yeah, there's dialogue and debate about how we should run our organizations that is somewhat pressure. One thing that has changed for a mistake that I think I certainly was making, and maybe some of us, others of us were making, was not allowing new voices in. You know, we weren't listening carefully enough to people in communities, and we weren't bringing those voices and values all the time in a proper way and an appropriate way to the table. And that has changed dramatically.
Could you be a little bit more specific? What voices were missing, or values you think were missing?
Well, for us, you know, we're policy. And we're looking at the federal and state policy level. Were we engaged with community organizations at the, you know, in an appropriate way? Were we bringing, you know, the right people to the table when we were formulating our policy ideas? Probably not as much as we should have been. And I think I have certainly grown there. And I think many, many people in philanthropy have, they've been out way ahead of me, but have brought us along on that front.
Now, you mentioned crises earlier, and there have certainly been a lot of them lately. And I'm not in that world, but as an observer, it seems that the foundation world in general has become better at managing and responding to crises than it used to. 9/11, maybe there was some work done there, but not anything like what you saw around the pandemic, what you saw around civil unrest, you know, what you saw around,
right,
you know, some political issues. So what, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, on COVID, I think, Gillian Darlow and I and Julie Stash we've already been talking about this a little bit, had established a group called the Partnership for Safe and Peaceful Communities. And that had a bunch of goals, which were great. But what it did was it put together about 70 or 80 foundation leaders in a regular cadence of talking to each other about issues affecting the city. When COVID came, it was a really fantastic platform for us to have regular communication with all of philanthropy in the Chicagoland. Not too many people weren't there. We would have 100, 150 people on our weekly calls. And so we were able to help shape a response, an appropriate response on COVID. Where were the funds needed? You know, should we be spending more on X or Y? Should a policy-oriented foundation like Joyce be actually spending money on direct services? The answer was yes. And we also had the Community Trust at the time was a tremendous leader on that at the city level. And then Penny Pritzker and her team devised a similar platform at the state level. And we all just dug in. I mean, it was an emergency, and it needed to be addressed. And we kind of put aside some of our traditional conventional guideposts or interests and so on to work on
boundaries.
That.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, yeah, boundaries, thank you. You're the writer on that. And then, you know, George Floyd and the civil unrest after that was similarly, in some ways it was more divisive because it was, you know, there were very, very different points of view, even among philanthropy leaders, about what was appropriate, what the problem was, and what the solutions were. And in a way, I felt I can only respond from my foundation and for what I'm hearing from my team. And there's a woman in our organization who's here today. I'm not going to embarrass her by giving, but we had staff people whose neighborhoods were completely wrecked. You know, a woman on our team who said, I buy groceries for my parents every Sunday. I now have to drive an hour to get the groceries to my parents. Stories like that. And then a woman on our team said to me, you know, there's a, when I go into my neighborhood, I know people know the name of MacArthur Foundation. People know the Community Trust. They don't know the Joyce Foundation. And this person said to me, I think it's time for them to know who's the Joyce Foundation. And that really, I mean, it changed. Bree, where are you? Yeah, and so Bree Perry was the person who said that to me, and it was just like a light bulb went off in my head that, yes, of course, you know, we should be working on these big issues. We should be working on policy issues. I do care about, you know, elections in Michigan, but this is our hometown. Mm-hmm. And so with the support of the board, we've you know, redirected about $1 million a year to smaller grants in communities that Bree has bit by, she's, and I'm always hanging on my wallet when Bree comes into my office, but you know, it was our way of responding in our way, and not trying to necessarily, you know, play a different role than we're used to.
It's another example of not wasting a crisis. You know, this opened your eyes, her comment, and the need opened your eyes. So there's other ways to do this and other ways to get this problem.
Yeah, and it's a good thing to remember you should listen to people.
That's right. So could you name one or two, I'm sure you have a ton of things you're proud of that you've accomplished, one or two things that have had a major impact on the Chicago region that Joyce has funded and supported?
Okay. Yeah, so one thing I'm proud of is that our board led a strategic planning process a long time ago where they said equity is the issue. Equity is the issue. Mm-hmm. Equity is the issue. And wanted to embed an equity theme into all of our programs. So I am very proud of that. But specifically, I'm proud of the work we've done on clean water, on safe streets, on democracy, and on improving educational outcomes. And let me just run through a couple of things. You know, on clean water, hundreds of millions of dollars has poured into the Great Lakes to keep them clean for all of us due to the advocacy of our grantees and others over decades. I am incredibly proud of that, and this is obviously a huge asset for the city of Chicago. And now, with our you know, really renewed focus on equity issues, and with the leadership of Elizabeth Caesar, who I know is here, I saw her in the back, maybe. Oh, there's Elizabeth. You know, we're focusing on what she calls the lake to the tap. Like, let's keep lead out of the water out of children's water, and let's look at what groundwater pollution is there. So we're looking at, you know, water quality issues from an equity point of view. On safe streets, like, look, you know, that's a huge, it's a huge issue in Chicago. I'm very, very proud of the work that our team has done on researching and evaluating what kinds of interventions make a difference, and funding, not being afraid to fund the advocacy around that, which many foundations, you know, can be dicey, as I was sort of referring to earlier. But focusing on policy, common sense gun laws, both in Illinois and around the country. Democracy issues have been really important to us. Our big victory recently has been a reform, redistricting reform in Michigan, and then improving education outcomes for all students. So teacher quality is such a critical, important impact on children's outcomes. Looking at test scores and graduation rates, college going, all of which are improving, but making sure we're focused on the data here, because there are improvements there, and if you don't focus on the data, you don't focus on getting those improvements or knowing that they exist. Last but really, really, really not least is arts and culture. I worked on that program when I started at Joy, so it always has a nice little warm spot in my heart. The 20th anniversary of the Joyce Awards to individual artists is this year. Some of the well-known names that have won these awards include Theaster Gates and Nick Cave and Julie Moretto, whose massive, massive piece will be decorating the Obama Library. And there were lots of lesser-known names who are making great art. A good colleague of mine said the other night, "There are no arts without the artists." So I'm very, very proud of the artists that we've supported, and we've had great leadership. Mia Kim is here, and she's currently running that program and doing a wonderful job. So I'm proud of all of those.
Yes, you should be, and that's a lot. I want to come back to the Safe Streets issue and gun violence, and you have done a tremendous work on that, and you were out there before, as you said before, a lot of other advocates and other big money sources were out there. But then you look around at what's going on in Chicago right now. You look at last weekend, we had more than 70 people shot in just one weekend, and then another maybe half dozen or so the next day. You look at what just happened with the Supreme Court decision on bump stocks. And especially if you're not as close to this issue as you are, you might despair and might say, where are we, and have we really made much progress? And what would you say? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, and another question. I wouldn't be surprised to get. There's 400 million guns for, 300 million people, and how do you change the dynamic? But first of all, you have to understand what the causes are, and then you have to understand what interventions actually make a difference. And one of the problems has been that the U.S. Congress has cut off all of the funding for research and evaluation. That's changing now, thanks to the advocacy of our grantees and Tim Daly and his team. If you don't look at the problem and try to understand it, you're never going to solve it. So I think the Joyce Foundation, Tim, what percent of the research money?
24% of the published
24% of published research on gun interventions has been funded by the Joyce Foundation. That's not right. We need more people
nationally. That's fabulous.
But let me just say there is progress. There are things like, and I'll describe one. This is a little technical, sorry, but we are nerds at the Joyce Foundation. We started something at Harvard, 25 years ago, called the National Violent Death Reporting System. It's now at the Centers for Disease Control. This is a 50-state, each state has all the data about gun and violent death in their state, and they can then see what the problem is. And I'll give you an example. The state of Minnesota has a very robust data collection system, and the governor and the head of Department of Public Health in the state of Minnesota looked at the data and said, wow, most of the homicides are in the big city. Well, that's where most of the people are. But the percentages look really weird up in this county in northern, northeastern Minnesota. You can tell I'm not a Minnesotan. But northeastern Minnesota. Why is it bright red there? What's the problem? What are all these gun deaths? Oh, wow. It's largely suicides. And who's the population? It's Native Americans. So Native Americans are committing suicide with guns at a super high level. Huh, Department of Public Health. There's something that's like a fact that we can understand and we can do something about. Mm-hmm. And so having that kind of information is what we're after. And that's a long-term play. Mm-hmm. One thing most people don't know is that over 60% of gun deaths in the United States are suicides. And that's not true in Chicago, but it is true nationally. And so getting at that problem is an area that's ripe for improvement. On Chicago, look, we have to have unified leadership. If the city does not have a unified plan for addressing gun violence, everything we do or any advocacy group does, it's not going to add up unless there is a city plan that puts together all the pieces.
Is anyone working on that? Is anyone pushing for that?
We push for it like every minute, but I think others are. Yeah, I think people are pushing for it. I mean, the things that have to happen, there has to be police reform. And part of that is we've gotten, and I've talked about this at City Club before, there is a consent decree. If you follow the consent decree, if we can get through the consent decree, you could have reform in the Chicago Police Department. We now have a good, strong leader in the police department, and I'm encouraged by that. But there also has to be the community violence interventions that have flourished in Chicago. And there has to be reduced access to guns, which is essentially gun policy. I mean, those are the three things that have to come together in our view, and we've been pushing at them. We're going to keep pushing.
Is there anything new coming down the pike that you, or something relatively new that you're doing that would help address that? The Joyce, I mean?
Well, one of the things that we're very interested in are these so-called red flag laws. Red flag laws are in, I can't get the number, Tim, 24 states now? 21, okay, 24, 21. But red flag laws are laws, they're kind of all over the map what they say, but they essentially say if you know someone who is at risk of harming themselves or harming someone else, and you know that, and you know they have a gun, that the gun can be either permanently or temporarily taken away from that person. So these are, I think this is a very promising set of interventions that need to be evaluated, and we're funding the evaluation of those. But that's a new thing.
So going forward, the future, there are many challenges. You just described as one of the challenges facing this region. What keeps you awake at night as you go out the door? You're going to still care about Chicago. What do you most worry about in terms of the challenges facing us? And what can philanthropy do more of to address that?
Well, obviously, violence in our communities is something that keeps us all up at night, and figuring out what the solutions are to that. And having worked on the issue for so long, It worries me that I'm not sure what the path is there. It's such a complex problem. So that's something that concerns me. But I think philanthropy needs to stay behind it, and the Partnership for Safe and Peaceful Communities is growing, and they will be there, even though I will not. And I feel really good that there's leadership and a staff in place that really cares about, particularly focused on CVI, which is what it's called, but also open to other ideas. So that's a good thing.
Opportunities, the things that we should be thinking about or thinking about differently.
Well, another way to frame that is, like, what's my hope for Chicago? Okay. And Chicago is such a great, great city. And my hope for the future is that it's one where everybody feels safe in their communities. Everyone feels safe in their communities. And that the opportunity to enjoy what's great about our city is more equitably distributed in our city. To me, that's going to make for a great city. So that's my hope.
That should be such a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, should be.
Should be. We've got to work on that.
Yeah.
One more maybe fun question before we move to your questions. And I know someone's collecting questions from you, so if there's any that you want to bring up now, we can get to those in a moment. Another interesting factoid about your tenure is that you've served under four Chicago mayors. So I'd like to get your take. I'd like to get your take on each one of them, working with them.
Laura, I'm not that relaxed. Let me just say, I don't like to think I've served under four mayors, but I have served in a city with four mayors. Yeah, so I started out with Mayor Daley, and then we had Rahm, and then Lori, and then the Mayor Johnson. And each of them has their strengths. Each of them has their interests. And I think one of the things we're good at is figuring out, like, you know, what's our mutual interest and how do we move forward on it. So I'm not.
Well, can you give an example of something you did with each one of them that was, you know, which something you worked on with Daly, okay, with Rahm, with Lori Lightfoot, with Johnson?
Okay. I think there was a misstatement earlier on when I was being introduced that any time I talked to Mayor Daly about something I was enthusiastic about, it immediately happened. That was laughable. But we did share a lot of interests, particularly on gun issues. I mean, he was passionate about the issue. He understood the policy side of it. He worked really, really hard on that, and he was a great partner. Those were definitely the old days, but there was no press event or media event on guns where I wasn't like, get over there, it's at 9:55, and put on the podium. I mean, he saw us as a partner on that, and we definitely were a partner. I think, let me just say, one of the things we understand, and that's because of, you know, relationships and so on over time, that the city doesn't always have money to fund certain kinds of things that you think they have all this money, but they don't have that flexible money. And we were willing to put money into projects that were under the various mayors, and guns was one. Mm-hmm. Mayor Emanuel and I go way, 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 way back. When did we meet Mayor Emanuel, Jane?
I was 24, you were 26.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. So
you were 26.
I was 26. And so we've known each other a really long time. And we had some, like, moments, I would say, when he was in Congress. I can't remember, Nina, if you were in the room, but he came into our office, and he had that little finger, and
the missing one.
But he was using it. He was using it, and the subject was guns, and he was like, that's a loser. You're never going to get anywhere with that. It's a loser, loser, loser. And I'm like, okay, I'll take that as a challenge. But on the positive side, there was nobody better on Great Lakes water issues. I mean, he knew how to count noses in Congress around the Great Lakes. And so he started in when he was in Congress, and he continued it as mayor. He was incredibly effective and powerful, and an important part of us getting, as I said, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into Great Lakes restoration. So big, big supporter on that.
And he's still big on water. He talks about water in Japan, you know, all the time. Whenever he comes here, he talks about how he's educating people in Japan about the importance of the availability of water.
I think we educated him a little bit. So we found many, many ways to work together. And he came around on guns. He became, you know, a huge proponent of all sorts of really important policy issues. Mm-hmm. And the amount of power that he had, in Congress and as mayor was really remarkable. So Lori Lightfoot, before she ran for mayor, was the Rahm-appointed chair of the Police Accountability Task Force. And that Police Accountability Task Force, which you may or may not remember, was absolutely the thing that led to a focus on police reform, and it raised the voices of people in communities. Her energy level and her capacity to go to these many, many, many community meetings where she would sit at a panel and people in the audience would be, you know, loudly commenting about their views on policing and why their communities weren't safe and so on. I watched that, and it was really, really impressive. We and a number of other funders paid for that whole process because we thought it was important to keep it out of City Hall, you know, and we didn't want it to be tainted by politics. When we saw the report, it was just like, not tainted by politics. Oh my, it was really rough. And so because we had that relationship, starting out, we continued to have a relationship there. is the current mayor, you know, has obviously deep interest in necessarily so on violence reduction, and we're looking forward to lots of opportunities to work with his team on those issues as well.
Have you actually, are you actually finding anything that he's working on right now? Or
yeah, we are, and you know, I've met with him a number of times, mm-hmm. and he's attended some of our things. So you know, we're developing ways to work together. Particularly on violence reduction.
That's one of his big issues, and it's still early. So
yeah.
Okay, so I have at least a couple questions, and we have time for more if there's anyone else out there. John Bracken, John, are you here from the?
Hi, John.
From the Digital Public Library of America, asks, what is the partnership you built that you learned the most from?
Well, that's interesting. Can I give you two?
Sure.
All right. Well, one thing I would say we learned a lot from, and this was, I was working with a woman named Gretchen Crosby Sims, who was with us for a number of years, and it was during the Obama administration. We were really interested in the idea of competition and prizes, and you know, like, could you fund, is that a way to make policy change or social change? It was kind of a trend at the time, but and we started out with, like, let's do competitions and prizes as an idea. We had all of these relationships at the federal level, and we had our little suitcase of ideas, and we went from office to office, and you know, were rejected by a number of people, but we kept going, and we ended up in Arnie's office. And we focused on community colleges and community college success, and was there something we could do there? And the partnership that we had with Arnie and with Jill Biden, because as everybody knows, she's, you know, deeply committed on, anyway, long story short, we ended up with the Aspen Prize for Community College Excellence, which is a competition every 2 years. There's $1 million prize, and community colleges around the United States try to win this prize, and there are very specific outcomes that we're looking for. It's mostly success rates of low-income and minority students, graduation rates, and employment rates. There's other things too. It has changed. I think it's changed the community college system in a way that we could only hoped for. President Obama, okay, he was exaggerating a little bit, but he called it the Oscars of the community college world. We were very honored by that. But that was a partnership that involved the federal government. It involved some real good wonky brains about how you design a prize. It involved hiring the right person. It involved a partnership at Aspen. And then it was designed properly to get the result that we wanted. And so that it was complicated, and it took time. But I'm both proud of it, and it... Yeah, I'll stop with that. That's a long example, but there were others like that. I guess partnering with Mike Bloomberg was another learning experience in a highly, totally different way, yeah. Which is, you know, fearless, more money than, like, 100x dollars, and really, really political. And they were spending a lot of money on the political side, which, of course, we cannot do, in partnership with policy advocacy, which we could do, and that was really interesting to me and a real learning experience. I think that lasted, we probably worked with them for 10 years, and having a dynamic multi-billionaire mayor leader as a partner was also really, we learned a lot from that about how to operate in the world.
Did that get kind of messy at times, given the politics and having to make sure that you didn't step over the political line?
Yeah, we know what we're doing. We never.
After dealing with going through the Barack Obama era, that was chump change. Huh?
We know where the lane. Yeah, exactly, chump change. Yeah.
Okay. Sean Hoyer from the West Care Foundation. Hello. He asked, please offer an example in which, upon reflection, the Joyce Foundation was either ahead of or lagging behind a social issue in its policy efforts and thus felt out of step? And then how does the Joyce Foundation stay in step?
Well, I can't give a simple answer to any questions, I guess. Sorry. I think we were leaders for a long time on education reform, and one of the things we really focused on was teacher quality, a lot of the things that we focused on have fallen out of favor now. Other funders have dropped away. Other powerful influences have risen up. And so I don't like to say we're behind the curve, but we're not in favor as we once were. We're not leading the charge as we once were on certain kinds of education policy issues. That doesn't mean that we're stopping. We are very stubborn. And I think it actually, in some ways, makes us more influential because our voice is still out there, and our focus on data, our focus on certain, I already went through, you know, test scores, graduation rates, employment rates, college going, college completion. Like, those are the things that really matter for broad swaths of the population. But it's definitely true that we're not in the ascendance at the moment, but we're going to be.
And you talked a little bit earlier about the sort of the community grassroots focus. That was something that took a while for you to embrace and to.
Yeah, really good at talking to mayors and governors and CEOs. Like, that's what we were really good at, and figuring out, like, that those are not the only voices that matter. And how do you open up to new ideas is really important. I'm not answering your question, but I imagine people say, like, why are you stepping down?
I was going to ask you that.
Oh, okay. Do you want to ask me that?
Go right ahead. Why are you stepping down now, and what's next for you?
Yeah. So one of the things I heard myself both thinking and saying was, well, we tried that, and it didn't work. And when those words came out of my mouth, I'm like, oh, no. This, you know, it's time. Somebody new can come in and not say those words or not think those words and try some of the same things again. And maybe they're going to work in a different way, in a different environment. But that they say, you know when you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of it for me.
So you know.
Yeah.
You
know. Now I feel good.
And what's next?
I'm going to take a break, spend some time with my family. I've got some travel plans. I've got an 18-month-old grandson who gave me the happy dance when I showed up at his house last weekend. He's like, and, you know, it's not every day you get that happy dance from anybody, so I'm going to take it.
You can't beat that. That's better than any job.
Yeah. And then I'm on the Advance Illinois board, which is one of my big proud things that I worked on. I hope to stay on that board as long as Robin doesn't heckle me off of it, and a couple of other boards, and we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens.
Is there another job in your future? Job?
Not that I'm aware of. and I feel very confident that whoever succeeds me is going to be great, and will be continuing, you know, many of the core, I hope all of the core things that we've been working on. So I feel great about that too.
What's the timetable on the announcement for the successor?
Yeah, probably in a month or so.
Oh,
you know,
soon.
And when?
And when are you there until that the new person comes on? And when are you actually?
Yeah, I'm going to be till July 31st. And then,
so get your phone calls and emails and everything.
I know, and I've been getting a lot of those.
About 6 weeks left.
But I'll be lurking around the city after that. So
certainly hope so.
All right.
We have any other questions?
Thank you. Let's give both Laura and Ellen a round of applause.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Ellen was giving me a look like, tell him to sit down. A couple of things. It's not every day that you get... Ellen is the standard of being able to mesh political, philanthropic, and corporate Chicago together. She is the standard. You guys can applaud for that, too. And I say that because I've watched her not necessarily from afar, but we've all seen her work. And when you see literally all of the philanthropic community here to support her and to hear what she has to say, that just tells the story. So, Ellen, I'm just going to wait for the book.
The tell-all.
And I don't know about tell-all, Laura, but, you know, I'll certainly be waiting for the book because she is the standard, as I said. And we don't often get an award-winning journalist to sit here and interview. We appreciate that so much.
Yeah, thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This was so full of little nuggets. I'm actually going to have to go back and listen to the interview on live stream, from the mayors to, you know, putting together the organizations that are moving things forward. And what we take away most is the data tells a story, and that's what Joyce does. So thank you all, Joyce, for being here and doing what you're doing. This is so rich of so many things, and it's not necessarily bittersweet because, as she said, she's confident that whomever she brings along is going to be, or that Joyce brings along is going to be more than capable. So we are certainly looking forward to that. And I'm going to say it, I'm sure Dan's wheels are already turning. I'm sure they are. Somebody's phone's ringing. We are looking so forward to what you've left behind, Ellen, but what you're going to spring forward to.
Thank you.
And one last thing, point of personal privilege. Someone said that we would not be the city that we are without Ellen Alberding and Kelly Welsh, and that is just the truth. They have done so much for our city. And I'm a little biased, but, you know, you can talk to me about that later. They have poured so much into our city. And can I just say, when it comes to philanthropy, no one does it better than Chicago.
That's right.
We really don't. I mean, we really do. When you look at other cities, you hear conversations about them trying to do it. But I'm sure Joyce, I'm sure CCT, I'm sure you guys all get questions about how we do it so well. And I think it is because of people like Ellen. So thank you so much. I'm sure that there are a ton of people who want to either get on her calendar or talk to her right now. So I am not going to belabor the point. Dan has already told you about our upcoming events. And when I tell you there is more to come, we are going to get Dan a plaque or a t-shirt or something that says that, because that is literally how he thinks 24/7. And when I say 24/7, I'm literally saying 24/7. So thank you, ladies, for being here. I want to just take one moment to not only thank the Joyce staff, but all of the other staffs of the philanthropic community, try to say that fast, in Chicago. And then I don't want to leave out the Maggiano staff and our City Club staff. This stuff doesn't happen without them. It does not happen at all. I mean, Steve can tell you, it takes great people to pull these kinds of things together. And the talent that they have, it certainly isn't my strong suit. So thank you all for being here today. And we look forward to seeing you at the next event, which is Thursday, yes. So come early to secure your seat. And again, thank you. We'll do a quick photo. We stand adjourned. Thank you.